How did two blood pressure medications get FDA approved for ADHD? And how do you use them in practice? Welcome to the Carlette Psychiatry Podcast, keeping psychiatry honest since 2003.
I'm Chris Aiken, the editor-in-chief of the Carlette Psychiatry Report.
And I'm Kelly Newsom, a psychiatric NP and a dedicated reader of every issue. In this month's Carlette Report, we brought you a new research update on guanfacine. It's probably the last industry-sponsored study of this recently gone generic medication. Check it out in our October issue if you haven't already. In this companion podcast, we're going to get more into the nuts and bolts of how to use guanfacine, otherwise known as Intuniv, and its alpha agonist cousin clonidine, brand name Capvay in ADHD. Clonidine and guanfacine were first released as antihypertensives, clonidine in 1966 and guanfacine in 1986. Their approval in ADHD came much later, in 2010 and 2011. So Dr. Aiken, how did these blood pressure medications come to be used in ADHD?
This one is a story of rational drug discovery, and it began in the 1930s when scientists figured out how the frontal cortex works. Later, they discovered that this part of the brain was impaired in ADHD and that guanfacine and clonidine enhanced prefrontal cortex functioning. Much of this research took place at Yale, where neurosurgeons, neuroscientists, and psychiatrists were all working alongside each other and sharing ideas. For example, when the child psychiatrist Donald Cohen was treating tic disorders in children, he invited George Agajanian with them on rounds to see a child with particularly intractable tics. Dr. Agajanian had been studying clonidine for opiate withdrawal, and he saw a similarity between the disinhibited movements of opiate withdrawal and the tics. He suggested they try clonidine, and it worked, and we continue to use clonidine and guanfacine for tics today. This made Dr. Cohen wonder if clonidine might treat another disorder of disinhibition, ADHD, and he and Robert Hunt conducted the first study of clonidine in ADHD in 1986. Now, clonidine is a sedating medication, and at the time, they weren't sure if the medication was inhibiting impulsive and hyperactive behavior through its sedative effects, but in a lab nearby, Amy Arnstein and Patricia Goldman-Rakeek were linking clonidine and guanfacine's cognitive benefits to the prefrontal cortex.
Dr. Aiken, what exactly is the prefrontal cortex?
The prefrontal cortex is like a mental sketch pad where we can store recent memories and draw from old ones to regulate our behavior, thoughts, and emotions. So, suppose you're going through the TSA to get on an airplane, and they notice something suspicious in your bag and ask you to step aside. Hopefully, your brain will recall past times where you had to interact with authorities and guide you to act in a way that doesn't get you detained. That's an example of drawing on old memories, and it's also an example of set shifting, which the prefrontal cortex is also involved in. Set shifting, which is measured by things like the Wisconsin Card Sort test, is usually impaired in mental illnesses like schizophrenia as well as ADHD. It means that one minute you're negotiating with a taxi driver to drop you off at the right airport gate, and the next minute, you're negotiating with an officer of the law about a pair of scissors they found in your suitcase. Here, the rules of engagement have changed, and your brain has to shift sets. You'll see problems with set shifting with your patients when they come in and tell you that their boss is terribly unfair and always coming down on them, when what really has happened is that the rules have changed in the workplace and the patient hasn't caught on to the new set.
Aren't the frontal lobes involved in executive functioning and planning for the future?
Yes, they do that as well. The prefrontal cortex is involved in making long-term plans so you can maneuver your way through school and careers. It helps you stay on track towards short-term goals as well. And as you move toward those goals, the prefrontal cortex keeps your brain from wandering into distractions, rushing in on impulse, or getting stuck in compulsions, things that don't go well in untreated ADHD. The role of the prefrontal cortex in memory was first discovered by a neurosurgeon at Yale, John Fulton, And I have a lame claim to fame with Fulton from my days as a medical student there. Fulton's house was turned into a neuroscience research institute at Yale, and it was a grand old mansion overlooking New Haven. I actually lived there as a medical student. My job was to make sure the pipes didn't burst and the place didn't catch fire, which I succeeded in. And the hallway outside my bedroom was covered floor to ceiling with human brains from John Fulton and Harvey Cushing's neurosurgery lab, all lined up in jars from the 1920s and 1930s.
That sounds like a dark gothic tale, like something out of that movie Young Frankenstein.
Yeah, but if you're a young budding psychiatrist, it's a pretty good dig. But there was a darker side to Fulton's work. He was the first to observe that when the frontal lobes were cut in monkeys, the monkeys became calm and subdued. And this led Antonio Mones to perform the first lobotomy in 1949. Lobotomies took off as therapy for schizophrenia and various behavioral disorders in the 50s and 60s. We often scorn them today, but they are heralded as great cures at the time. The Kennedy family sought one out for JFK's sister, and Dr. Mones was awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine for his discovery of the lobotomy. Psychiatrists today are not too different from 50 years ago, and we can learn a lesson from that past. I highly recommend PBS's American Experience documentary from 2008, The Lobotomist. It reveals how our enthusiasm for new therapies can blind us.
So on one hand, Fulton's discovery led to the lobotomy, and on the other hand, it led to guanfacine and clonidine.
Yes, Fulton's work on the prefrontal cortex spawned other research at Yale, and it laid the groundwork for the basic science and then the clinical studies of clonidine and guanfacine in ADHD. Robert Hunt, who was at Yale and is now in private practice in Nashville, conducted the first clinical trials in ADHD of clonidine in 1985 and later guanfacine in 1995. And there's one thing worth knowing about these early studies. It's that they used the instant-release formulations. Later, when it came time for their FDA approval, the company switched to the extended-release versions because the instant-released ones had gone generic. That's why only the XR versions are FDA approved in ADHD.
For a while, that held these drugs back, because they were very expensive to prescribe in the FDA-approved forms. But that doesn't matter so much now, as the ER versions are both generic.
And I would recommend starting with the ER forms, because these are the ones that are FDA-approved. But there are times when you may need to switch to instant release, like if sedation is a problem and you have to manage that by giving one short-acting dose at night. And if you do that, here's a tip. Much of the ER form does not get absorbed, particularly with guanfacine, so you have to lower the dose a touch when converting to the instant-release form. When switching from guanfacine XR to the instant-release, lower the dose by about 40%. That'll make up for the fact that not all of the XR is actually absorbed. And when switching from clonidine XR to the instant-release, lower the dose by about 10 to 20%.
But if you give it all at night, how does that help ADHD during the daytime?
Unlike the stimulants, the alpha agonists have a delayed effect in ADHD. They build up gradually over 2 to 4 weeks. This is probably because their pharmacodynamic effects are more downstream. They start by activating alpha-2 adrenergic receptors in the brain, and this inhibits the action of downstream neurons in the prefrontal cortex. Now, I wouldn't recommend the single evening dose strategy for everyone, as most studies dosed it twice a day as instant release or once a day as extended release. But evening instant release dosing worked in some studies, and I found it effective in practice, so you can do it. Also, the half-lives of these medications suggest that once a day dosing is feasible, particularly in adults. Guanfacine's half-life is about 18 hours, while clonidine's ranges from 6 to 18, generally around 12. But these half-lives are shorter in children, because children metabolize medications faster, and that's another reason why the XR was developed.
Clonidine is the more sedating of the two, but what are the other differences?
That's right. Clonidine has stronger sedative and stronger hypotensive effects than guanfacine. This can be a plus if insomnia is a problem. In terms of their differences and choosing between them, that's a hard one because these two alpha agonists have never been compared head-to-head. But judging from the clinical trials, they do appear to have similar benefits in ADHD. And notably, those benefits are smaller than what we see with the stimulants. It's hard to beat the stimulants. Methylphenidate and amphetamine's effect sizes are among the largest in psychiatry. Clonidine and guanfacine rank more in the area of atomoxetine, Strattera. Their effect size is about 30 to 50% smaller than that of the stimulants.
There are a few other technical differences between the two. Guanfacine is more likely to become the victim of drug interactions. It is metabolized by CYP3A4 and CYP3A5. So 3A4 inhibitors like fluvoxamine, nifazidone, desvenlafaxine, and grapefruit juice will raise its levels, while 3A4 inducers like carbamazepine and St. John's wort will lower its levels. Clonidine is less prone to drug interactions because it's metabolized by many enzymes in the liver. But clonidine suffers a separate fate when it comes to withdrawal. It's notorious for causing a rebound hypertension if it's suddenly stopped. Guanfacine also does this, but less so. Both drugs should be stopped gradually. Lowering the dose by 1 mg for guanfacine or 0.1 mg for clonidine every 3 to 7 days. But hypertension is not the only withdrawal symptom. Patients can also experience headaches, racing heart, nausea, flushing, hot flashes, lightheadedness, and anxiety. So which one would you use first, clonidine or guanfacine?
Child psychiatrists tend to prefer guanfacine because it's less sedating. Physiologically, guanfacine has weaker presynaptic actions, but in animal studies, guanfacine had stronger effects on working memory than did clonidine. So I wouldn't say that these two meds are the same, and some patients may respond better to one versus the other. As an adult psychiatrist, I often find more reasons to use clonidine. Adults with ADHD often have complex comorbidities. In fact, those comorbidities often leave us unsure if ADHD is really a true diagnosis here in adults. But clonidine has potential benefits in a lot of these comorbidities. Here's a short list of some of the conditions where clonidine has proven useful. 1. Opioid withdrawal. Clonidine is often used to treat the symptoms of opioid withdrawal, but a recent study found that continuing clonidine has preventative effects against opioid relapse. 2. Borderline personality disorder. Clonidine is the only medication I know of that can be taken as needed to prevent self-cutting in borderline patients. It worked better than placebo there. 3. Autism. The transdermal version of clonidine was used in a 1992 study where it helped social relationships, emotional reactivity, and sensory responses in autism. The dose was around 0.005 milligrams per kilogram per day, which equates to around 0.2 to 0.4 milligrams a day, depending on the weight, similar to what we use with ADHD. 4. Irritability. Clonidine has been used for aggression and irritability in various populations. 5. Tic disorders. Stimulants can worsen tics, but clonidine, as well as guanfacine, improves them. 6. Smoking cessation. Guanfacine actually has some evidence here as well. In a study from the 1990s, people were less likely to smoke under stress while taking guanfacine. And here's a tip if you use varenicline, Chantix, for smoking cessation. One of the main side effects you'll see with Chantix is vivid dreams, and clonidine actually treats vivid dreams, as well as helps smoking cessation, so the two can be used synergistically there. 7. Insomnia and anxiety. 8. PTSD nightmares. 9. Perimenopausal hot flashes. 10. Sweating, which is a common side effect of SSRIs, and 11, mania. There are 6 small trials from the 1980s of clonidine in mania.
That's just about every psychiatric disorder except schizophrenia.
Yes, neither of these alpha agonists have very clear results in schizophrenia, But they were studied there. The studies are small and the results are unclear. But guanfacine is gaining ground in schizotypal disorder. There was an interesting randomized controlled trial last year in the American Journal of Psychiatry where guanfacine improved reasoning abilities, problem solving, and social cognition in schizotypal personality disorder. It's a follow-up from a similar study from 2007 by the same research team, which is led by Margaret McClure. This is important because people with schizotypal personality will often present with ADHD-like cognitive symptoms, and the last thing you want to do is give them a stimulant which can trigger psychosis. You know, schizotypal personality was discovered by Seymour Keddie's group at the NIMH. They were interviewing the relatives of people with schizophrenia to figure out if the illness had a genetic basis, and they discovered that many of the relatives had odd and eccentric personality traits that eventually became classified as Cluster A personality disorders, schizoid, schizotypal, and paranoid personality.
Okay, so let's recap. Guanfacine and clonidine sharpen the prefrontal cortex, which is involved in a lot of disorders like ADHD, autism, and schizotypal. What about age-related cognitive decline? The prefrontal cortex declines with age, starting around 45, and the decline becomes sharper after age 75. Are these meds useful there?
That's less clear. Amy Arden's group at Yale published a controlled study of guanfacine in the elderly in 2018, and it did not work. So it may be that the prefrontal cortex declines with age in ways that guanfacine's mechanism doesn't address. These alpha receptor agonists don't work for everyone. We covered age-related cognitive decline in April 2019, and this month, our October 2020 issue, we have an update on a medication that did work in age-related cognitive decline.
And back to ADHD. I've heard it said that guanfacine and clonidine work better in younger children, like under age 12, than they did in teens. And these are only FDA-approved in childhood ADHD, so do you use them in adults?
Yes, they're not FDA-approved in adults, and that's another thing that has held back their use. And in our October issue, we cover the first randomized controlled trial of guanfacine in adult ADHD. Check it out online and use our special podcast code, PODCAST in all caps, to get $30 off your first year subscription.
But now it's time for the word of the day, dissymbola.
If you ever find yourself with two Y's and two S's in Scrabble, dissymbola is the word for you. D-Y-S-S-Y-M-B-O-L-E. Dissymbola is a type of concrete thinking characteristic of schizophrenia and other disorders. It is an inability to describe personal emotions or to express thoughts about personal topics or the self, so they have a hard time saying what's going on the inside. The word was introduced in 1939 by psychiatrist Ian Skatoev, and it comes from the Greek word for bad or poor, that's dys, and the French word for symbol, so it means the patient has poor symbolic representation of their inner life. Here's how Dr. Skatoev first described it.
The patient cannot use the right word symbols to convey what is in his mind or what he feels, and he is aware subjectively of a change. He is aware that something has gone wrong with his thinking process, but he cannot formulate what he feels about it because the very function which he would use to put his feelings into language is the very one which has gone wrong.
So now you understand a bit of what's going on when you see a young adult with new-onset schizophrenia struggle to convey the terrifying changes that are taking place inside them.
A related word is alexithymia, which describes a similar phenomenon on a less psychotic level. We'll save that for next week.
If you like this podcast, please share it and rate us on your Apple Store. And if you got feedback, send it to us at asktheeditor@thecarlattreport.com.
The Carlatt Report is one of the few CME publications that depends entirely on subscribers. And that helps us stay free of influence from the pharmaceutical industry and bring you unbiased information you can trust.